can be seated. Find Song of Solomon. Song of Solomon, chapter number 2. On these Sunday mornings for 10 weeks, we're going through the book of Song of Solomon. And I've asked the singles class, the college and career class, to be in here during the summer for this. I really think that the theme of Song of Solomon is marriage, marital themes. And so we have in here both young and old in this class right now. And we've got, of course, a lot of you that are married, many of you that are not married, one that is planning on getting married here pretty soon, Aaron and Trinity. And so we have some in here that are not married and wish that you were. And perhaps some in here that are and wish they weren't. I don't know. But either case, then this book is definitely for you. I don't have time, of course, this morning to go back to the very beginning. But I believe that this first section down through chapter 3 and verse 5 is the first act or the first scene in this love drama. And the way that I have divided it or broken it down is chapter 1, verse 2 through 8, the Shulamite is describing a courtship between her and Solomon. Solomon, the king, goes up to the north country. He finds an unnamed maiden. She's called the Shulamite in this book. I believe that they fall in love over a romance, a courtship. They eventually are married, and she moves to the palace in Jerusalem. That's the essence of the book as I see it. Verse 2 through 8 describes a courtship. Verse 9 through 14, I believe that the scene is a wedding banquet. It's on the day of the wedding. Chapter 2, verse 15 down, or chapter 1, verse 15, down through chapter 2 and verse 7. We looked at last week, it is the honeymoon night. And then we come to chapter 2 and verse 8. And we'll cover all the way down to chapter 3 and verse 5 this morning. Reflections on courtship. It is not strictly chronological. She is now reflecting. She's thinking back. She's been married, and now she's thinking back on the beginning of their relationship. And so this is what they would call a flashback scene. In one of his sermons on Song of Solomon, Charles Spurgeon, that Prince of Preachers, said that a good marriage is like a little bit of heaven on earth. And for those of us who are still in love with our spouses, we would wholeheartedly agree to that. But the sad reality is that many homes are more like hell on earth. I have personally known married couples that fight so much that it made you wonder why they ever got married in the first place. How could two people who seem to hate each other ever think that they were ever in love in the first place? Then there are young couples who have had rocky relationships before their marriage, but somehow thought that marriage would be a public or a magic pill and their problems would just all go away once they got married. They discovered that marriage doesn't bring tranquility and peace to the relationship. In fact, it usually only gets worse. When two people are courting or considering marriage, that courtship stage, that is the time to talk through any potential issues that this marriage could have. It is not the time to ignore warnings. It is not the time to sweep things under the rug. It is not the time to avoid having difficult conversations. You'll remember this story, I'm sure, that I've told you, and some of you may even remember being here many, many years ago. There was a young lady in our church who was engaged to be married to another young man from another state. Both this young man and this young woman were both very good Christian young people, come from good Christian homes. They remained pure. They were doing everything right. And they were going to be married here at the church with me officiating. It was going to be a very, very large wedding. And family and friends had come in from all over the countryside. The church fellowship hall was decorated. The auditorium, this auditorium, was filled. I mean, it was filled with guests that had come in for the wedding. We were literally minutes away from the wedding march and the procession and the ceremony
to start.
And the bride was hidden back in her private room, wherever they go to, getting ready. And she was in tears. And it was not out of joy or nervous anticipation. She was frustrated to the point of tears. And unbeknownst to me, the groom's mother was a very domineering type woman. And she had been pushing her weight around. She had upset everybody in the wedding party. She was demanding last minute changes to the ceremony as if it was her day, not the bride's day. And she was generally bossing everybody around, including the young man and the young lady that were about to be married. And the young lady, she had tried to take it in stride, and she had tried to keep her composure and just try to work around her, but it was just too much. And finally, it all just caved in on her on that day. And now she is in a room with her family and a very nervous groom who's trying to console her to get her down the aisle. It became clear in that room and in that conversation, they told me there was a problem, so I went back there. And it became clear that the mother-in-law-to-be had really been an issue in this relationship all along. It didn't just start then. She didn't understand boundaries. The young man didn't know how to cut the proverbial apron strings for him as mother. The young lady felt like that she would always play second fiddle to his mother. That's a terrible way to start a marriage. And it all came to a head finally, just minutes before the wedding, and minutes before we are to walk down the aisle, and with an auditorium full of people. But better to find out these things before marriage than after marriage. Her father, a good friend of mine, very wise man, he realized this is a serious issue that should have been confronted before now, but it's going to have to be confronted. So they asked me what I thought, and I said, I think that it is futile to think that your mother-in-law is going to respect you after you marry her son. She is going to have to be gently but firmly made to respect two adults who are setting out on their life together. So her father and I both talked together, and I told him, I said, I'm not putting it off on you, but if you don't give her away, I'm not going to marry her. And he said, they're not ready for marriage. And they both agreed. We've got to fix this before we start this marriage. So I came to this pulpit with an auditorium full of people expecting the procession. And I said, ladies and gentlemen, there is an issue that has come up. And I said, we are postponing the wedding for another day. We do have cake. We do have cake in the fellowship hall. I invite all of you to go to the fellowship hall and just enjoy yourself. And we canceled that wedding. Now, fortunately had a good ending, because the young man mustered up enough courage to confront his mother about her domineering ways. She realized what she was doing to the relationship. She began to work toward forging a new relationship with the young lady. They worked through those issues. The young couple, about 4 or 5 or 6 months later, set a new date, had a wedding, much smaller ceremony. Many years later, they are still happily married. But unfortunately, many similar stories do not end as well. Every marriage is going to have problems. It is best to work through them before you enter marriage. And many times the approach that love-struck couples take is that we know there are issues, but we're going to just love them away. I know that all my family doesn't like her, doesn't like him, and I know he's a bum, and I know all of these things, but I'm going to work on her, I'm going to work on him after we get married. And I believe that this section in Song of Solomon exposes the fallacy of that kind of approach. And it offers some help on how to resolve issues before they become big problems. Now, this is a unique section, chapter 2, verse 8, down through chapter 3 and verse 5. It takes us a time back to before the wedding between Solomon and the Shulamite. She begins to reminisce on the not too distant past when Solomon would come visit her in the north country. And she recalls with great kindness the walks that they took and the talks that they had, and even some concerns that she felt. And because this is before marriage, there's no There's no sexual scene. There's no themes like that. There's no intimate talk. There's not even a description of their appearances, because that wouldn't be appropriate before marriage. And the Shulamite, what she does is she describes a visit that Solomon paid her. And either it was a particular trip, or it was representative of many trips that he had made. And she describes how they got to know each other, how they grew together, how they talked about sensitive matters. And so in these sections, I'll give you two parts of this. I see two things here. And the first part is, I want you to notice that there is a growing fondness. Look at verse number 8. The voice of my beloved, she's speaking. Behold, he cometh leaping upon the mountain, skipping upon the hills. My beloved is like a roe or a young hart. Behold, he standeth behind our wall. He looketh forth at the windows, showing himself through the lattice. Now, the scene has been at the palace in Jerusalem, but the scene has shifted now. It is to the country. It's back to where the Shulamite lived. And she's thinking back to a visit that Solomon had made and her excitement to see him coming. And in her mind, she describes him approaching, and he's coming, and he's leaping and he's skipping upon the mountains on the hills. He's coming like a young deer, and nothing will stop him to get there to see her. Now, obviously, he's not a Superman. He can't do that. Okay, but she's using poetic language. She's describing his excitement to see her. In verse 9, when he gets there, she sees him standing outside. He's peering in the windows through the lattice work, and he's just trying to get a glimpse of her. He is smitten with love, and he cannot stay away. Now the principle is so simple that we don't think that we even need to mention it, but maybe we do. But a young couple that is thinking of marriage ought to have that kind of eagerness to be together. You ought to be, now this is for the young people, you ought to be, when you get to that stage, you ought to be madly in love and consumed with being together, and not even care if there's anybody else in the world except the two people in this relationship. There should be no one that you'd rather be with than the person that you are marrying. If a young man is engaged and he would rather hang out with his buddies than with her, and I've only got one engaged couple right now, so this is not just for you, Aaron, all right? But do listen. But if a young man would rather hang out with his buddies than hang out with his fiance, there is something wrong with this scenario. If she finds him boring, and she dreads another date, because he's going to drone endlessly about whatever subject she has absolutely no interest in, if she finds him boring, then there is something wrong with this relationship. If the spark and the fizzle is already beginning to die before you get down the aisle, there is a strong indicator this is not the makings of a great marriage. But I'm speaking to a lot of people that are married. So I would say this morning that if the desire to be together has died in the marriage, then you need to pray for the Lord to rekindle that fire. Now, you don't want to be possessive. You don't want to be jealous. You don't want to be overbearing. But do you enjoy each other's company? Do you still want to spend time together? Do you see yourself and your spouse spending time together after the kids are gone? Or will you wonder what we even had in common after the children have left the house? And a lot of couples look at each other after the kids are gone and say, "Who are you?" You don't want that to happen. It continues in verse number 10. My beloved spake and said unto me, "Rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away. For lo, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone. The flowers appear on the earth, the time of the singing of birds is come, and the voice of the turtle is heard in our land. The fig tree putteth forth her green figs, and the vines with the tender grape give a good smell. Arise, my love, my fair one, and come away. O my dove, thou art in the clefts of the rock, in the secret places of the stairs. Let me see thy countenance. Let me hear thy voice. For sweet is thy voice and thy countenance is comely. The Shulamite is speaking, but she's remembering a particular time that Solomon had come to visit her. And what these verses describe is Solomon taking her, I believe, on a walk with him and talking to her. I think as reflected by the language, it is springtime. And they're strolling. I can see them strolling through the woods. Come away, my love, my fair one. The winter is past. The rain is over and gone. And so I see them talking, spending time together. Maybe a walk in the woods, and they're sharing their hearts with one another. Now I've read a lot of commentators, and I've got a preacher friend. There are several preachers that I've shared with them that I'm preaching through Song of Solomon in Sunday school, and most of them chuckle or laugh at it, and ooh and ah. But I've got one preacher friend that evidently thinks that I need some help. He has sent me some books on Song of Solomon. I appreciate all the help that I can get. And one of the commentaries that he sent me, it reads every phrase, and he makes this whole section sexual in nature. In all of these phrases, I really don't think that it is. I really think that it does nothing more than them taking a springtime walk and they're enjoying nature together. The beauty around them only reflected the beauty of their love. He calls her his dove in verse number 14. Oh, my dove. That is somehow a pet name. He says, I want to look at you. I want to hear you. She remembers when he told her that your voice is music to my ears, that you are the most beautiful creature that I have ever seen. That's what's being described, and nothing more. Their love is in full bloom, just like the spring flowers around them. They could spend hours together. It would seem like moments. They could talk about anything for hours. Time would just pass away. The world could melt, and they wouldn't even notice. I remember when a few years ago when Jacob got interested in Anna, and long distance relationship, Florida, New York, long distance. So most of this courtship is going to be by phone. And I remember when we'd been in Austin, Texas, and we were with the Camilleri family. We came back this way. He was interested in talking to her, getting to know her, and. And we don't do the whole dating game, you know, date six girls and break up with five. We don't do all that stuff. And so he called her father, Brother Joe, and said, I'm interested in getting to know Anna. So he gave Jacob permission to call Anna. So for the first time, she knows now because father has talked to daughter. She is aware. And so he's going to make this first phone call. Of course, I thought, being a wise father, that I should be there. I should... speakerphone, I could guide him. Wasn't to be. And so I remember that he took his cell phone out. He went out into the driveway and got in the car. Felt that was soundproof. This is the first phone conversation that he's going to have, just to see if there's anything there. We're all sitting in the living room, waiting, bated breath. What did she say? And we waited. And we waited. And I think the first conversation was over 2 hours. 2 hours. That's a good sign. It's a good sign. Well, you know, the next night he called her again. And every night he would sit in that car. And he'd talk to this girl for hours. Hours. And I said, what in the world could you possibly be talking about every night for hours upon hours? Surely by now you've solved all of the problems of America. Surely by now you've discussed all theology, and you've got to know if she believes in the hypostatic union and all of the, what else is there to cover? Are you giving her a Bible? That's what are you doing? And it was every night. Do you remember that? When you couldn't stay away. When you couldn't wait till the next time that you was with him or with her. That is how marriage ought to be. And there's probably really a very small minority of marriages that after kids and 3 jobs and bills and all the stuff of life still has that spark. But even if your marriage has lost that spark, you should not settle for a cold marriage. You should enjoy talking to each other and spending time with each other. It is a sad thing to watch an older couple who's been married for years sitting at a dinner table in a restaurant and they never speak to each other. That after all of these years, we have nothing to talk about. There is a growing fondness. There's a second thing that begins in verse 15. There are some growing fears. Look at verse 15. Take us the foxes, the little foxes that spoil the vines. For our vines have tender grapes. Now, I'm not sure who's speaking here. I don't know if it's him or her, and I don't know that it really matters. As they're walking through, they come across perhaps a vineyard, and maybe they see in the distance some small foxes, and they're digging at the roots of a... Foxes are nocturnal, which means that they sleep during the day, hunt at night. Okay? And foxes are known to burrow themselves, dig holes, burrow themselves in the ground. And maybe what they have done is that they have noticed that there are places in the vineyard where foxes have burrowed themselves and dug holes under the root system of the vineyards, and the vines are beginning to die. Maybe it's just a metaphor that they're using. Foxes are always in a negative light in the Bible. But little foxes represent little problems. And the one who is speaking, whoever, if it's him or her, whichever one it is encouraging the other one to have an open dialogue and honest discussion about even small problems that could potentially be destructive in a marriage. I got to tell you something. Problems don't go away by themselves. And popular to contrary opinion, time does not heal all problems. Most problems unresolved only become much bigger problems. Mistrust and jealousy and selfishness and pride and unforgiving attitude. It may seem manageable now, but if you leave it unresolved, it becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. One of the books that my preacher friend sent me was by a man named Joseph Dillow. Joseph Dillow, the title of the song is Solomon on Sex. I was a little embarrassed that he would send it to me, but it is a commentary on Song of Solomon. And it actually is very good. I'd never heard of this writer before. And here's what Joseph Dillow says about this section. He says, every couple must guard the relationship against little foxes, the small things that can become big issues. Both partners must foster an atmosphere that is open to honest communication. Both partners must be willing to acknowledge wrongs done and to make changes. Both partners must be willing to forgive offenses and not carry a grudge. On the other hand, many little foxes are not wrongs at all, but are simply differences in background, preferences, and ways of doing things. In these cases, both partners must be willing to make concessions and to compromise in order to live happily and peacefully. The words I do are not magic words that instantly make both spouses perfectly compatible. A couple that cannot communicate about the differences and work them out before they are married will not be able to do so after they are married. The little foxes teaches a very important lesson. Solomon did not discuss with the others the details of what was bothering his darling, the things that were threatening the vineyard of their love. Likewise, every couple should be careful about trust. The element of trust is absolutely essential in marriage. A married couple will know each other intimately in every imaginable way. God designed it to be so. Therefore, husbands and wives must be able to trust each other to keep their relationship as well as their shortcomings private. And how important it is in a marriage that both big and little differences be resolved before marriage. If you can't work problems out before your marriage that you know are an issue, then you're not going to work things out after marriage that you don't know are an issue. Because, see, before you get married, you discover that you all agree on religion and education and the meaning of the universe. Then after you get married, you discover that she squeezes the toothpaste in the middle of the tube, and that becomes a big deal. A marriage where conflicts cannot be resolved agreeably and without conflicts and without feelings being hurt is a marriage in trouble. And too often times a married couple attacks each other rather than the problem. Somehow he thinks that it is productive to cast blame and to show her all of her faults. All that it does is creates more tension in the marriage. And if you allow little foxes to spoil the vineyard of your love, then what you ought to do is you ought to honestly face the problem and honestly bring it up and speak the truth. And ladies, don't make him guess and be a mind reader. Say what is bothering you. And don't convince yourself that it's unimportant. If it's a big deal to you, it ought to be a big deal to her or to him. And how can somebody fix something if they don't know that it's broken? And take responsibility for your attitudes and for your actions. And don't blame the other person, because usually one person is not 100% at fault. So find out your part of the problem and fix your problem first. If need be, ask forgiveness of the spouse and then very graciously approach your spouse with that issue. And speak the truth in love. Kind confrontation. And if you can't do that, then you've got a marriage that is desperately in trouble. She says, little foxes spoil the vines. Now, I believe that in the following verses, that the Shulamite is speaking, and I think that she verbalizes some of the uncertainties and concerns that she's experiencing. I think she has some questions that she needs to resolve in her own heart before she becomes the wife of King. Look at verse 16. She says, my beloved is mine and I am his. He feedeth among the lilies. Until the day break and the shadows flee away, turn, my beloved, and be thou like a roe or a young hart upon the mountains of Bether. Try real hard not to read any more into each statement than what is very obvious. It's very difficult, I think, to have the right take on verse 16 and verse 17. All right? I believe that what she is saying is that we are devoted to each other now, but what about after our marriage? The phrase, he feedeth among the lilies, it is a separate thought, complete thought. You have a colon there. So it's two complete thoughts. My beloved is mine and I'm his. Complete thought. He feedeth among the lilies. I think that what that's referencing is him as a king shepherding his people. I don't believe that she's describing him as a literal shepherd. I believe she's describing his work in language that she would understand. Will he be devoted to me in all of his duties as the king? Verse 17, it sounds like, and again, I'm cautious, it sounds like that she's trying to say that she hopes he can take care of his business during the day, and before it's too late, he can come and spend time with her. I know that he'll be busy, but it doesn't change her desire for him to be as swift as a deer and come home as soon as he's able. She says, until the day break, the shadows flee away, turn, my beloved, and be thou like a roe or a young hart upon the mountains of Bether. Now here's an interesting thing. No Bible scholar has ever been able to identify a mountain range in Israel called Bether. There's no mountain ever named Bether. So what is she talking about? The Hebrew word for Bether means divided or separated. And it could be that she's not talking about a particular mountain, but she's saying whatever it is that divides us, whatever it is that separates us, I want him to be like a deer and to be able to overcome that. Some commentators think that in verse number 17 that what she is saying is that she is telling Solomon to turn, to go away before the night falls, lest their desire becomes too great. I think she's saying just the exact opposite. I want you to come. I want you to spend time with me as the day comes to a close. Difficult verses. I think that's the correct interpretation because of chapter 3 and verse 1. And I look at chapter 3, verse 1 through 5 as a continuation of that. And in chapter 3, she's got a thought that bothers her so greatly that she has nightmares about it. And that's what she describes in the following verses. Look at chapter 3 and verse 1. She says, by night on my bed I sought him whom my soul loveth. I sought him, but I found him not. I will rise now. I will go about the city and the streets, and in the broadways I will seek him whom my soul loveth. I sought him, but I found him not. The watchmen that go about the city found me. To whom I said, saw ye him whom my soul loveth? It was but a little while that I passed from them, but I found him whom my soul loveth. I held him and would not let him go until I had brought him into my mother's house and into the chamber of her that conceived me. Now very clearly, it's a dream. She says that. It is not something that actually happened. She thinks about what life will be like once she is married, and she dreams that she wakes up one night and he's gone. And so she gets up in the middle of the night, she gets dressed, she goes out in the streets looking for him. She finds watchmen and she asks, have you seen my beloved? Have you seen my husband? They have it. She's wandering through the streets, calling his name. Finally, she finds him. And she's so relieved that she will not let him go. That's the essence of the dream. She makes a reference in verse 4. I held him and would not let him go until I brought him into my mother's house and into the chamber of her that conceived me. Most commentators take that phrase and they make that a sexual reference. And I don't think that it is. I think the reason she says that is that that is a euphemism for the safest place that she knew. A woman greatly desires security. And she's not feeling security in the relationship. And she's probably not saying that I want him to take me back to my mother's house, but that's where she felt the most secure. And when she wakes up, she is saying that I want that security. I think that that is what she is saying. He hasn't really left her. He is still there. I have gone through these verses, this whole section this week, and I've looked at this, and I have looked for a more spiritual application. I've told you that I don't allegorize the Song of Solomon. Okay? And I know that marriage itself is a type of the relationship of Christ and the church, much spiritual application, but I'm trying to focus on what is the primary interpretation of this passage, of this book. And I've tried to spiritualize this passage, and here's the way that I could approach this. I could take this whole section, and here's what I could preach, that just as love had won her heart and she wanted to be with him, so Christ's love has won our heart and we should desire to be with him. And just as it was him coming as a shepherd when he won her, but will come back as a king to get her, so the next time he comes to get us, he will come differently. And just as it stirred her heart to hear his voice, so it should stir our heart to hear his voice. And I suppose you could say that just as she was like a dove hiding in the clefts of the rock, we could make some kind of parallel to Rock of Ages cleft for me, perhaps. I don't know. I know that we could certainly take verse number 15, the little foxes. We could talk about spiritual problems that do hinder our relationship with Christ. And I don't criticize that. But I've tried to look at the book through the eyes of the two main characters. And I don't have time to go back and talk about interpretation, but original intent, original audience. And here's what I see in these verses. I see two people that are madly in love with each other. They're spending time together in a courtship. They're growing together in a relationship. And that even means talking about potential issues. It is a great model for courtship. And not just for courtship, but even after marriage. Do you pay as much attention to your spouse now as you did before you got married? Gentlemen, do not be married to your career, to your job, to your hobbies, whatever it might be. You may have to work long hours, but when you come home, be home. Family time is good, but time alone with your spouse is better. It is a mistake, by the way, to make children the center of their home. You do realize they're not, hopefully, not permanent fixtures. They didn't start this relationship. And don't look at your wife after the kids are gone and say, who are you? I don't even know you. I believe that's what this passage is about. You You don't have to court after you got married, because courtship, the goal is marriage, so once you get the girl, then what's the point? But you should court after marriage. You should go on dates. You should take trips together. You should grow closer together, not farther apart. And maybe you have to rekindle the fire, because it's sad to see two people that once were madly in love, and now they just live in the same house. That's not how marriage is supposed to be. Reflections on courtship. Let's